From a conference on global learning at Elon University in North Carolina, I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Ted Hankin is a professor at City University of New York who specializes in Cuba. His latest book, Entrepreneurial Cuba, looks at how the communist island nation has shifted its policies towards small businesses and how everyday Cubans use creativity to get things done.
Cubans use that kind of mentality to keep a 57 Chevy running in 2017. And so that same philosophy they apply to getting the internet without the internet.
But first, Professor Paul Worley and I will discuss the first indigenous woman who's running for the presidency of Mexico.
Which also goes back to, you know, the revalorization of indigenous knowledge, you know, on the national stage, right, as legitimate alternatives to how things are done under late capitalism in Mexico.
That's all coming up after this news from NPR. Paul Worley from Western Carolina University. Let's talk Mexico. So some interesting things going on there. One of them that I personally find very fascinating is that the first indigenous woman has been essentially nominated to become president. So 2018 is going to be the first year where an independent candidate can vie for the presidency. And she has been put forward by the National Indigenous Congress as well as the Zapatista National Liberation Army. Her name is Maria de Jesus Patrico Martinez. What can you tell us about this?
So it's incredibly interesting, right, as well as incredibly important. I think in a lot of ways, this is the culmination of years of not just Zapatistas arguing for independence, the defense of rights, autonomy, land in Mexico, but also for the visibilization of indigenous women. I think it's incredibly important that Maria de Jesus is a 57-year-old mother of three. Right? You know, demonstrating quite clearly that just because one is a mother, one does not belong in the home.
Right? And she does herbal remedies for the community. She's very well known.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. In 1992, she founded a traditional clinic in the town of Tuxpan. And that's something that she continues to today, which also goes back to, you know, the revalorization of indigenous knowledge, you know, on the national stage, right, as being, you know, this is indigenous ways of being are legitimate alternatives to how things are done under late capitalism in Mexico.
Well, tell us a little bit about the state of indigenous people in Mexico. What is the situation there? Like many other places throughout the world, history of being minimalized, a poor education system, lack of access, education, medical attention, those sorts of things. That's also accurate in Mexico.
Yes. So one of the big differentiations, for the sake of your listeners, between the situation in the United States and Mexico is, you know, in the United States, indigenous is an actual, or Native American is an actual legal category. Right, recognized by the state, as opposed to in Mexico, where the national identity, kind of like the melting pot in the United States, right, is, you know, we're all mixed race mestizos, right? And so as part of that, sort of popularly, what that ends up doing, right, even though everyone says we have both European and indigenous heritage, it renders indigenous people frequently relics of the past living in the present. And so, you know, it walking on the street, women who wear indigenous dress, people who speak indigenous languages are automatically seen popularly, not by everyone, but by many folks as being people who refuse to get with the national program, right? You need to learn Spanish. You need to quit doing this. You need to quit doing that. And so, you know, over since independence, Mexico has gone through several different generations of what they refer to as indigenista politics, right? So indigenous politics, looking to, as they have theorized since the 19th century, how to solve the Indian question is how they've always put it. And we see a really big change with that in the late 1970s, when instead of the government trying to do this from a sort of top-down perspective, they actually started seeking the participation of indigenous peoples in those politics, right? Creating indigenous cultural promoters, supporting languages, things like that. And, you know, 1994, with the Zapatista Rebellion coming to the forefront, going live on January 1st, that's when we get the sort of next big break, right, where indigenous politics really, you know, are completely at the forefront with indigenous actors as being actors on the national scene and not spoken for.
Well, we will definitely see if she is able to get that nomination, and we'll keep an eye on this. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU. Next, Suzette Gerlot will talk with Ted Henken about the challenges, policies, and attitudes towards small business in Cuba. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Ted Henken is a professor of anthropology and sociology at the City University of New York. He's an expert on contemporary Cuban culture and society, and his most recent book, Entrepreneurial Cuba, explores the changing landscape for businesses on the Caribbean island. Our regular host, Suzette Gerlot, spoke with Henken earlier this year.
Ted Henken, welcome to Worldviews.
It's fabulous to be with you.
So, Ted, you're an expert, a scholar of Cuba, and we're all fascinated, you know, with Cuba these days. Many of us have not been able to travel there. You've been there many times, so studied it for a long time. Tell us first, though, how you developed an interest in Cuba, how you ended up going to Cuba and spending so much time there.
Well, this goes back to the 90s when I was working as a social worker, actually, in Mobile, Alabama. Before I went to graduate school and after I finished college, I've always been interested in the world and other cultures and travel. And one of the ways that I kind of harnessed that was to work with immigrants in the United States. And so I had a job at Catholic Social Services in Mobile, Alabama. And I was resettling. I was hired, actually, because I spoke Spanish. I was resettling Cuban refugees who were coming in from Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. This was the same year where I had worked with a Head Start program as a social worker with undocumented Mexican migrant labor who were coming to Alabama to harvest potatoes. And so it was just a fascinating experience to be exposed to these two different Latin American and Caribbean cultures, Spanish-speaking, but who had very different, let's say, origins, cultures, and who, when they arrived in the United States, got completely different treatment. The Cubans were welcomed as refugees from communism and given really a helping hand, and the Mexicans were hiding in the shadows, but doing the good work of harvesting the crops for Alabamians and for people across the country who would buy those crops. And so when I worked with the Cubans, they would tell me stories about life in Cuba. And I was intrigued. And so I decided that when I went to graduate school, and I started graduate school in 1997 at Tulane University, that I would kind of try to go deeper and try to go to Cuba to find out about the place that they were telling me. And so that was my initiation into Cuba and its diaspora and its, you know, uniqueness.
So when you mentioned the immigrants, the differences between these communities, clearly their treatment and the fact that one was out in the open and one was in the shadows, as you mentioned, and that they were welcomed differently, or one welcome, not welcome. But were there any other differences between these two communities? I mean, they obviously have a different historical trajectory, but culturally and in other aspects, how would you distinguish these communities? Cubans from Mexicans.
Well, I mean, the big difference, as you mentioned, is the legal treatment, and which is interesting because that ended in January. The last thing that Obama did vis-a-vis Cuba was to end the wet foot, dry foot policy that gave Cubans special treatment. I used to tell people that when most immigrants came to the United States undocumented, they ran from La Migra. The Cubans ran toward La Migra, right? Because they would get to register and get legalized, right? Culturally, they're very different. I find that, and I was working with Mexicans who were from rural indigenous communities, so they were a particular kind of Mexican. They weren't representative of all Mexicans by any means, but I found that they brought with them this millennial indigenous culture, which was much more religious, much more, let's say, fatalistic in the sense that, you know, life deals you a hand and you have to play it. Whereas the Cubans, they would try to, you know, put an ace up their sleeve. They would try to fix the system, work the system. They were always looking for an angle. Cubans, in my experience, are, even though they've been cut off from the United States for 50 years, 60 years, they are ultra modern. They believe in angles and figuring out a way. If there's no way, they don't take what's dealt with them, they figure out how to get around or get over or get under or get through. Also, Cubans are sophisticated because, this is my theory anyway, that because of the kind of political system that they live under, they're taught one truth that maybe 30% of the country believes, and then everyone else realizes that there's multiple levels that things operate on, and so they develop a sophistication about how they use coded language, what's true, what's propaganda. You know, a lot of Americans, in my experience, have the opposite problem, whereas we believe everything we hear, or we used to anyway, and so we're easily tricked because we kind of have a bright side mentality. Whereas the Cubans, they have a pessimistic mentality, and therefore they're for sophisticated at reading, you know, and seeing levels and shades of meaning and truth and manipulation.
That's a very interesting description of Cuban culture. Of course, I haven't been to Cuba, but I'm curious if your characterization of them as kind of being able to figure out a way through something, around something, into something, that they're very entrepreneurial. The name of your recent book is Entrepreneurial Cuba. Is this what you're referring to? Can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yeah, I mean, there's many applications of it. You could say that Cubans use that kind of mentality to keep a 57 Chevy running in 2017, right? And so that same philosophy, they apply to getting the internet without the internet, or running a business in a country that looks down upon or even makes illegal private enterprise. And so in one sense, it's a study of the economic policies of the government toward the private sector throughout the revolution. And it's essentially gone up and down, you could say swung back and forth between giving it space and trying to asphyxiate it, depending on various factors, mostly, you know, what was Fidel's mood and what was the general state of the economy. When they would crack down on the private sector, that would, let's say, be a win in terms of ideology and in terms of equality, but then productivity and efficiency would suffer and the economy would suffer. And so then, you know, 5 or 6 years later, when things got tough, they would then allow it to grow again because it would provide goods and services that the state couldn't efficiently or productively. So that's, you know, that's the government side. The fascinating thing that drew me to it as an ethnographer was to see all of these mom and pops, all of these families inventing businesses with very little capital, with very little resources, with an idea and a way to get a piece of the pie. Remember, during the 90s, Cuba started opening up to international tourism, so there were foreigners with dollars, hard currency in their pockets, walking around. The government had mostly monopolized that through their state-run hotels or resorts. But Cubans were like, well, I'll set up a bed and breakfast in my own home. I'll turn my living room into a restaurant. I will use the car that I got from being a Vanguard worker in the 80s as a taxi. And so I remember one time I went to the very kind of famous beach resort of Varadero, which is kind of Cuba's Cancun. And I was looking for a place to stay. I showed up without a place to stay, and I asked the waiter in the restaurant that I was eating. I said, "Hey, I'm trying to find a place to stay." And during his smoke break, he took me to 5 bed and breakfasts within 15 minutes that were in walking distance. I settled on one, and I checked in, and they said, "Well, you can stay here tonight, but don't come before 9 o'clock." And I was like, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Don't worry about it, but you have a place to stay." So I came a little bit before 9 o'clock because I was curious. And they actually, out of my bedroom, they were running a restaurant. And then, you know, I got there 9 o'clock, the restaurant closed, and then I had my bedroom. So the Entrepreneurial Cuba was kind of highlighting all of the 1,001 workarounds that Cubans have figured out, both when it was illegal, when it was tolerated, and when now it's being encouraged, this kind of micro-enterprise sector. It's really not a true private sector. I would call it a micro-enterprise sector. And these are some of the most interesting and common uses of it. Private restaurants, what are called paladares in Cuba, bed and breakfasts. And now that there is air, so there's Airbnb. They had B&B before there was air for 20 years, but now they're connected to Airbnb and private taxis. So that's kind of one of the illustrations in my book where I highlight these kind of innovations.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with Ted Hankin. He's professor at City University of New York and the author of Entrepreneurial Cuba. After the break, they'll talk about how Cubans are getting on the internet, even though they technically don't have access to it. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Our guest today is Ten Hankin. He teaches anthropology and sociology at the City University of New York. Before the break, Hankin was talking with our regular host, Suzette Grillot, about how attitudes towards entrepreneurs have been changing in Cuba.
It sounds like Cuba has been doing Airbnb and Uber or Lyft, you know, long before we have. This isn't necessarily the picture that many of us have of Cuba. You mentioned the 1957 Chevy, for example. You know, the old cars, the kind of, you know, older architecture, the just different way of life that's kind of stuck 50, 60 years behind us. But it sounds like they've really managed to move forward and be more modern than perhaps we think. And particularly in connections, how about the internet and things like that? I mean, how are they able to you know, connect socially on the World Wide Web?
Now, the worldwide digital revolution left Cuba behind. And Cubans on the island in the last 15 or so years, but especially in the last 5 years, have been trying to catch up. And this is kind of promoted, ironically, by Cuba's very good educational system. But people then graduate and don't have options for work that are, you know, that will pay well, and are often cut off because of the lack of access to the internet. So Cubans have come up with 1,001 ways to get what's on the internet without actually getting access to the internet. So one of the things that they have developed, probably the most interesting and fascinating thing, is called El Paquete, the packet. And this used to be weekly, now it's a daily thing, but basically, in Cuba, the internet is really reinvented on a flash drive. And so there are people, various secret ways, who get access to the internet and download massive amounts of data on a weekly basis, almost a terabyte of information they'll download onto a hard drive. And that will include everything from Game of Thrones and House of Cards to video clips from, you know, Univision, whether it's news, to music videos, to apps for your cell phone, to newspaper and magazine articles. And now there's even Cubans in Cuba who have independently developed magazines and newspapers that they don't publish because it's illegal to publish them in hard copy, but then they put them into the packet and they circulate informally but massively throughout the country. It used to be a kind of a minor phenomenon. Now it's a mass media phenomenon because, again, the Cuban government monopolizes the official media, and there's only, you know, three or four television stations. So this is the alternate media that has many ways eroded and swamped the dominant media, and it rides on the back of a flash drive. And if you want to get it, you just certainly, you let the right person know, and they'll show up weekly at your house, knock on your door, and install onto your computer, right, your shows or your subscription. Or you can go to certain places that are officially known as cell phone repair shops, but you go in there and then they'll upgrade your flash drive to this week's shows, right? And it's a nominal, you know, couple dollars a week fee, and you get all of these shows. And sometimes they'll see shows at a lower price and quicker than we'll see them here because they are that plugged in and they want the cutting edge things today and not next week or next month or next year.
So that's really incredible. Okay, well, I have to end with this. Obviously, under the Obama administration, we saw a good amount of change come to the relationship between the United States and Cuba. But now, under the new Trump administration, there's some question about where we're headed. Can you just tell us here in conclusion where you think this relationship is going?
It is true that under the last administration, the last 2 years of the last administration, we had major shift in U.S.-Cuban relations, a thawing, a normalization, or a process toward normalization, diplomatic recognition, setting up embassies in each country, and massive levels of travel from the U.S. to Cuba that have ramped up. U.S. airlines are now involved. Interestingly, the Monday following Fidel Castro's death was the first commercial airline flight to Havana from the United States in like 60 years. So all of this was happening. You have then the election of Donald Trump, and you have the death of Fidel Castro happen, you know, in the same month of November of 2016. What does that mean? Well, Cubans are nervous. because although a lot of the obstacles in their lives haven't essentially changed, there has certainly been a significant breath of fresh air, more money in the pockets of these entrepreneurs, more ability to travel, more access to information. And some of this has happened because of Cuban government decisions. Some of it has kind of been forced on the Cuban government. And some of it has been facilitated by the Obama shift or pivot, what I like to call it. And so the question is, which Donald Trump will make the policy toward Cuba? Will it be the businessman who will be convinced by, you know, conservative, free market Republicans to say, hey, this is actually one of America's values is trade, free market engagement through those values, and that can only help Cuban entrepreneurs. Yes, it's also going to help the Cuban government, but that is in many ways our calling card throughout the world, is our business engagement. And that will also be a positive thing for, you know, the farm states that want to export to Cuba, the port states that want to open up ports and have relationships, the tourism from Florida. But there's also another Donald Trump and another part of the Republican Party, and even some Democrats who want to, in my opinion, justifiably, but very kind of ironically and contradictorily, prioritize or keep hostage human rights to this economic opening. While at the same time, we have deep economic relationships with countries that have as bad or worse human rights records, like China, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. And so this has to do partly with the Cuban-American community and the fact that Cuba is not a real cost because it's not a real benefit given its size and the fact that we don't already enjoy it. But there's an argument being made by, let's say, more free market libertarian Republicans saying, no, this is a new market. And is also we can affect change in Cuba over the long term through engagement much better than we have been able to affect change through isolation and impoverishment.
All right, Ted, thank you so much for being here today and sharing these fascinating stories about this very interesting country not too far away. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Suzette Gerlot's conversation with Ted Henken. He's a professor at City University of New York and author of the book Entrepreneurial Cuba. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Suzette Gerlot, I'm Rebecca Cruz.